KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This is what the media does. They take anonymous sources from disgruntled former employees, and then they try to slash and burn people and ruin their reputations. Not going to work with me.
Fresh revelations that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth used his cell phone to share classified military information.
It is Monday, April 21st, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, how young Catholics who grew up under Pope Francis are reflecting on his tenure.
He's been so vocal about caring for the elderly, caring for the poor, caring for immigrants and refugees and people that need to be seen and healed at all stages.
Also, President Trump wants to build a missile defense system that's like Israel's Iron Dome, except it will be called Golden Dome.
It's the difference between a kayak and a battleship.
And as democracy erodes in Hungary, some Western countries are copying the strategies.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. Some Catholics in Chicago visited a popular downtown parish to pay their respects to Pope Francis, who died today at the age of 88. Adora Namigata of member station WBEZ has more.
Rosario Inez did not wake up with plans to go to St. Peter's in the Loop, but decided to attend midday mass so she could pray for him.
I saw it on Instagram, of all places. I was devastated.
She bought the late Pope a colorful bouquet of sunflowers and roses she got at the grocery store on her way to the church.
They were white ones and they felt appropriate, but at the same time, this one has so much color in it, and I feel like on this gloomy day, we just need a little brightness.
Catholics have been milling in and out of the church to pay their respects. For NPR News, I'm Adora Namigadde in Chicago.
More congressional Democrats traveled to El Salvador this week on behalf of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. NPR's Joel Rose reports the group is calling on the Trump administration to return the Maryland man who was illegally deported last month.
Four Democrats from the House of Representatives, including Maxwell Frost of Florida, traveled to El Salvador to show their support for Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
We want to see him, know he's alive, and know that he's well. But also, we want to make sure that this story doesn't go away.
Frost says they were not allowed to meet with Abrego Garcia because their trip was not sanctioned as an official congressional delegation. The Trump administration is refusing to bring Abrego Garcia back to the U.S., despite a Supreme Court order to, quote, facilitate his return. In court filings, the Justice Department confirmed that Abrego Garcia has been moved out of a notorious megaprison to a different penitentiary in El Salvador. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Federal regulators are suing Uber over the company's handling of subscriptions to its Uber One service. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports the Trump administration alleges the rideshare company overstated the savings and makes the subscriptions difficult to cancel.
The Federal Trade Commission accuses Uber of misleading customers about its Uber One subscription service, which offers discounts on ride bookings and deliveries. The agency says Uber, quote, promises people savings of $25 a month without accounting for the monthly cost of the subscription itself. The complaint also accuses Uber of billing consumers before the promised date and making cancellations convoluted. Uber, in a statement, argues its subscription processes are clear, simple, and lawful, and cancellations take most people 20 seconds or less. This is the first FTC action against a major tech company in the new Trump administration. The agency has continued to pursue cases launched under President Biden as well, including against Amazon. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. All three major indices are up about 0.3%, sharply different from the numbers at the closing bell. The Dow was down 971 points, the Nasdaq down 415. This is NPR News. The Environmental Protection Agency is considering changes to how it tracks carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports those gases are the main cause of climate change.
The Environmental Protection Agency currently requires thousands of factories and other industrial sites to report their greenhouse gas emissions. That means tracking how much carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide those facilities release. Those gases trap heat in the atmosphere, causing global warming. The information the EPA collects is the most granular and comprehensive greenhouse gas data available. Now, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin says the agency is considering changing its requirements. For example, some types of industrial sites could be exempted from the reporting rules. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
NASA's Lucy spacecraft beamed back pictures from its latest asteroid flyby, and the photos show the asteroid is bigger than scientists thought and is shaped like a lumpy bowling pin. Lucy came within 600 miles of the harmless asteroid this weekend in the main asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter. It was a dress rehearsal for the asteroid flybys to come. Lucy was launched in 2021 to study the unexplored so-called Trojan asteroids near Jupiter. 8 Trojan flybys are planned through 2033. On Wall Street today, stocks were sharply lower on worries about President Trump's continued comments on Fed Chair Jerome Powell. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had another unauthorized chat on Signal last month. The New York Times first reported this, and NPR has confirmed that Hegseth used his personal cell phone to provide his wife, brother, and lawyer with classified information about imminent airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen. This was on the same day that Hegseth provided similar information in a Signal chat with senior U.S. officials, as well as a journalist who was mistakenly added to that group. All of this has raised questions about Hegseth's viability in the position. NPR's Tom Bowman joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, also.
Okay, so much has piled up here, as we just mentioned. Last month, Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, was added to a Signal group where Hegseth provided minute-by-minute updates on plans for airstrikes that were about to happen. And Tom, what we are talking about now, just so I understand, is a totally separate, different Signal communication, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. I'm told he used his Pentagon cell phone for the first call and at the same time used his personal cell to send the same information to another group chat that included his wife, brother, and his lawyer. The information was highly classified, included flight times for U.S. warplanes, bombing targets, weapons to be used, minute-by-minute details. He was getting through secure communications from senior military officers with Central Command. And those on this call did not have clearances to get this information, which is closely guarded. Usually, Elsa, such details of pending airstrikes are not even shared with Capitol Hill until the attacks are finished.
Right, because if an adversary were able to intercept that Signal communication, they could alert the Houthis about the attacks, right?
No, that's right. An adversary could possibly intercept such information on this non-secure Signal chat and pass it on to the Houthis. You know, already the Houthis have shot down 2 U.S. Predator drones, so you can imagine the threat here. I know the New York Times interviewed F-18 pilots after reports of that first Signal chat last month, and they were pretty upset about this lack of security awareness. One pilot told the Times, you don't want to telegraph that we're about to show up on someone's doorstep. That puts the crew at risk. Now, after the first Signal chat, I had retired military officers reach out to me, and they were just stunned that this could happen and said if others did this, they would at least lose their clearances and maybe be criminally charged.
Well, what's been the response from Hegseth and from the White House?
Well, Hegseth was at the White House Easter egg roll today and did not address the second Signal chat directly, but instead said anonymous sources, disgruntled former employees were behind this. He said they, quote, slash and burn people and ruin the reputations. President Trump at the same event praised Hegseth and called the story false. Let's listen.
Pete's doing a great job. Everybody's happy with him. We have the highest recruitment numbers I think they've had in 28 years. No, he's doing a great job. It's just fake news. They just bring up stories.
Well, we know the first Signal chat was not fake news because a journalist was mistakenly placed on that chat by a White House official and put out some details of what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, the Pentagon Inspector General is looking into that one and will likely add this second chat to the investigation. And I am told by a source that the White House is considering replacing Hegseth, but White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt denied our report.
When Hegseth is blaming, quote, disgruntled employees there, who is he talking about exactly?
Well, several employees were fired, and they said they don't know why. And finally, another employee, John Elliott, who left, wrote in Politico that this month has been total chaos, a major distraction for the president, and it's hard to see Hegseth remaining much longer. But, of course, that's up to President Trump.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
The bells at St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican in Rome ringing this morning to mark the death of Pope Francis. He had just made his last public appearance yesterday at the same square for Easter Sunday. News of his death spread quickly around the world and resonated far beyond the church. To hear more, we turn to three of our correspondents in the Middle East, also Africa, but first NPR's South America correspondent Carrie Kahn.
The choir in Sao Paulo's main cathedral sang out during a special mass today for Pope Francis. Brazil's the country with the largest population of Catholic faithful. Sao Paulo's Archbishop Odílio Scherer said one of the Pope's unique qualities was his openness.
Abertura ao diálogo com todos, sem excluir ninguém.
And his openness to dialogue with everyone, excluding no one, he said. That's what's needed now to overcome this climate of polarization and antagonism, he added, echoing the Pope's sentiments. Today, Argentina's far-right libertarian leader said despite their differences, knowing the Pope was an honor. President Javier Milei had equated the liberal Pope with the devil and called him an imbecile who defended social justice when he ran for office. Francis welcomed him recently to the Vatican. Outside Buenos Aires' ornate cathedral, where soldiers perform their routine changing of the guard ceremony, high school teacher Veronica Lopez praised the Pope, who grew up in this capital, joined the priesthood late in life, and ultimately served as archbishop and later cardinal before being elected Pope.
Hablar de justicia social, un papa me parece que es...
Having a pope that speaks about social justice in this world that only cares about money is so important, she says. Pope Francis left his mark throughout Latin America on multiple trips through his papacy. He was instrumental in brokering a detente between the U.S. and Cuba and helped broker peace in Colombia's long civil war. He was an outspoken defender of migrants. In 2016, in a trip to the Mexican side of the U.S. border, he delivered a message to President Trump, then in his first term of office, saying anyone who built walls to keep migrants out was, quote, not Christian. Although tepidly received by Mexico's conservative hierarchy during that trip, crowds thronged to see him. I remember well the day my family waited in our then Mexico City neighborhood, deep in the pack, to watch him whiz by in the Pope mobile.
In the Middle East, it's not just Christians mourning the Pope's death. Francis was the first pope ever to visit Iraq, which is mostly Shia Muslim, and the United Arab Emirates, a Sunni Muslim powerhouse. The trips were part of his focus on interfaith relations. The elderly pope traveled to Iraq during the coronavirus pandemic, to a country still emerging from control by the militant group ISIS. Security forces foiled two attempts to kill him in Iraq. I covered his visit to Egypt in 2017.
Assalamu alaikum, cari fratelli e sorelle.
His appeal went beyond religion. He just made people feel good. One place, more than any other in the Middle East, though, had a special connection with the Pope, Gaza. There's one remaining Roman Catholic church there. Pope Francis was head of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. But he made a point of calling the Holy Family Church at 7 o'clock on the dot every evening, a parish official says. NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza talked to the church spokesperson, George Anton. It was never diplomatic or a matter of obligation, Anton says. It was the questions your father would ask you. How are you? Did you eat? Is there food? Is the water clean? Is anyone injured? War between Israel and Hamas has destroyed the Palestinian enclave. More than 50,000 Palestinians and at least 1,600 Israelis have been killed. Hundreds of people have taken refuge in the church. Two parishioners were killed in the courtyard in 2023. Anton says Pope Francis and his calls drove the fear from their hearts. Outside the church, children are playing soccer. Some have lost family members. With the loss of Pope Francis, Anton says, we feel truly orphaned.
Pope Francis always put Africa high on his agenda, traveling to some of the continent's most troubled countries. Excited crowds came out to greet the pontiff on his visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo 2 years ago, when he made a powerful plea for foreign powers to stop exploiting Africa for, quote, the poison of their own greed. Stop choking Africa, he said. It is not a mine to be stripped or a terrain to be plundered. In Juba, South Sudan, the same year, the faithful sung at his mass. Africa is home to a large and growing number of Catholics, over 280 million. The first pope to hail from a fellow global South country was beloved by many here. Francis tried to use his influence as a peacemaker in a region often beset by brutal conflict. In 2019, he shocked many when, in front of the world's media, an already frail pope knelt to kiss the feet of two of Africa's most bitter political rivals, South Sudan's Salva Kiir and Riek Machar.
Vi chiedo come fratello.
I ask you as a brother.
Rimanete nella pace.
Stay in peace.
The following year, both leaders did the once unthinkable, forming a government of national unity. When the conclave begins to choose Francis's successor, many Africans will be watching closely to see if the first African pope in centuries will be picked. Vatican watchers say there are two African cardinals who could be among the candidates, Robert Serra of Guinea and Peter Turkson of Ghana.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from Subaru, in partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In the past 15 years, as Hungary's prime minister, Viktor Orbán has steadily chipped away at democracy there. In a speech last month, the 61-year-old leader said there's a special place in hell reserved for opposition politicians, judges, journalists, and those in civil society. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Budapest, Orbán's strategies are being studied and in some places copied by politicians in democracies throughout the West.
Atop a cobblestone hill overlooking the Danube River and the medieval lanes of Budapest, tour groups surround a changing of the guard ceremony in front of a 13th century Baroque castle. Across the square, construction crews rebuild a centuries-old palace complex. That's where politician Ákos Hadhagyi guides a tour of his own. We are at the Buda Castle, and if you're looking for a symbolic place for corruption, power, and the waste of public money, this is a beautiful venue for that, says Hodhozhi as a Chinese tour group marches by. Hodhozhi is an independent member of Hungary's parliament. He routinely gives tours showcasing the corruption of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's government. The offices for the Prime Minister and his ministers used to be down there next to the parliament building, he says, pointing to Budapest's other big pointy-towered tourist attraction. But Orbán decided he wanted to move here, into a castle. Even Matyos Rákosi, Hungary's most brutal communist dictator, refused to move his office here. But Orbán wants to play king, says Hadhagyi, so the National Gallery may soon be forced to move out of the castle to make way for him. All this construction, Hadhagyi says, represents Orbán's gifts to cronies in the form of lucrative contracts while ensuring Orbán can survey his kingdom from above the capital. Viktor Orbán is in his fourth consecutive term as Prime Minister of Hungary. In that time, he has dismantled democratic checks and balances, taken control of the country's media, civil society, and universities, and consolidated power in himself and his Fidesz party. His step-by-step dismantling of Hungary's democracy is a point of fascination for political scientists around the world, including those advising the Trump administration. But Hadhagyi says Orbán is an easy read. It's not like Orbán is a genius politician, he says. He received his sheet music from Vladimir Putin, who came into power when oil prices were high. He channeled that money into oligarchs, and in return, they bought up Russia's independent media. Orbán franchised that model here in Hungary, says Hadhagyi, except he used European Union funds. The European Union has since frozen funding to Hungary, but not before Orbán took control of much of the country's independent media. What's left of Hungary's independent press can be found in nooks and crannies like this one.
Hello,
in a tiny apartment in central Budapest, a few dozen journalists from what used to be prominent newspapers that were one by one forced to shut down by Orbán's government have formed their own newspaper, Mogyorhang, or Hungarian Voice.
So we started from zero.
Csaba Lukács is managing director of the paper.
Nobody was brave enough to print in Hungary, so we have to find a printing company outside from the country. Until now, our newspaper is printed in Slovakia, in Bratislava, so we have to organize every week transportation of the newspaper.
Hungarian Voice is funded almost entirely through subscriptions, says Lukács. He says it's the only conservative paper in Hungary that is not part of a state propaganda apparatus. Lukács says Orbán has stripped away press freedom in a step-by-step process over the years.
We are not yet in Turkey because the journalists will be not jailed yet. We are not in Russia because nobody was falling out from the windows yet. But day by day, we are getting closer.
And day by day, he says, Viktor Orbán's attacks on the media and civil society get worse. Last month, in a speech commemorating Hungary's 1848 revolution against the Habsburg Empire, Orbán said, "We will dismantle the financial machinery that bought politicians, judges, journalists, pseudo-civil organizations, and political activists." He called these groups stink bugs who have survived the winter and need to be eradicated. A special circle of hell, declared Orbán, awaits them.
Akkor a pokolban külön bugyor várja őket. Ismerünk benneteket.
Political scientist Pedro Greco says Orbán is targeting the last bastions of Western democracy in Hungary.
Orbán just thinks that the West is unable to survive, and democratic and liberal practices of the West have weakened the West.
Greco has mapped out the process Orbán has taken to dismantle Hungary's democracy. Orbán began, he says, by weakening Hungary's courts, filling them with loyalists. He then applied pressure on media companies, either turning them into state propaganda or putting them out of business. Then, says Greco, Orbán took control over universities, appointing leaders loyal to him. Greco says Orbán focused on ridding Hungary of any institution capable of checking his power. And he says he sees similarities to how President Donald Trump is carrying out his second term in office. The difference, says Greco, is the pace at which Trump is operating.
I think Trump went further in 2 months than Orbán could in 15 years. The United States, it reminds me of a constitutional coup where everything happens very rapidly.
In public speeches, President Trump has called Orbán fantastic, respected, and said nobody is a better leader than the Hungarian prime minister. And while Orbán has boasted that his party has shared his strategies with Trump advisors, Greco doubts the help was very meaningful. He says Hungary serves as more of a conservative fantasy land that mega Republicans can aspire to.
So Hungary as the country where you don't have immigrants, where you don't have woke issues, when gender ideology is not dominant, and when family values is strong. So this is clearly a construction of Hungary that has nothing to do with reality.
That's because, says Greco, Hungary is surrounded by Europe and its open society. Budapest's annual Pride Parade is one of Europe's largest. Last month, Orbán's party pushed a new law through parliament that has banned any assembly that, quote, promotes homosexuality in order to, quote, protect children. This week, Hungary's parliament passed an amendment to the constitution doing the same. At a cafe in Budapest, Pride Parade spokesperson Johanna Majercik says this new law will likely go further than banning the Pride Parade.
So if the government succeeds in banning such a peaceful protest, that means that in the future they will be able to ban or restrict any other peaceful event, any other peaceful demonstration organized by another social group.
Many other Hungarians agree. After this public assembly law passed, tens of thousands of people halted traffic and bridges in the capital in what have become weekly protests. Critics of the new law say Orbán is using the LGBTQ community as a tool to shut down the right of Hungarian citizens to freely assemble in peaceful protests like these, particularly at a time when the opposition to Orbán's rule is beginning to gain momentum. But political analysts say Orbán, nearing the end of his fourth consecutive term as Hungary's prime minister, appears to be, yet again, adapting his step-by-step strategy to hold on to power for as long as he can. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Budapest.
This is NPR News.
The Catholic Church begins 9 days of official mourning after the death of Pope Francis. Various rituals are planned, all leading up to the selection of a new pontiff by the College of Cardinals. Now, as the world reacts to the news, many are wondering what's next for the church. We'll explore the possibilities tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, the final phase of a landmark antitrust trial against Google.
A federal judge will decide what penalties Google will face after finding the company abused its control of the online search market.
This case is an extremely big deal. It's hard to overstate it.
That's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The Vatican is making preparations for the funeral this week of Pope Francis, who died Easter Monday at the age of 88. He had battled acute respiratory illness in recent months, was released from the hospital, and was able to bless the Easter Sunday crowd from his wheelchair. His cause of death was a stroke and ultimately heart failure. President Trump has ordered all federal and state flags at half-staff to honor Francis. The president spoke at the White House.
He was a good man, worked hard. He loved the world, and it's an honor to do that.
Around the world, people are mourning the death of the Pope. In Australia, crowds gathered at churches. As Scott Maiman reports, Francis was well-regarded there.
Malcolm French was in mourning at a special church service in Sydney after the news broke.
I just took a moment to pause because he has obviously been such an influential person in the Catholic Church.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who is Catholic, was somber and emotional while paying tribute in Melbourne.
His was a papacy of firsts, the first pope to hail from the Americas, the first Jesuit pope.
All this week, flags will be at half-staff across Australia as a mark of respect, while Australian Catholics grieve a profound loss. For NPR News, I'm Scott Maiman in Canberra, Australia.
NPR has learned that the White House appears to have begun the process of looking for a new Secretary of Defense, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly. The White House calls the report fake news. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth continues to find himself mired in controversy for sharing sensitive military information in an unsecured group chat. On Wall Street at the close, the S&P 500 lost 124 points. This is NPR. Today was the first day back to class for Florida State University students after a gunman killed two people and injured six others last week. As Regan McCarthy of member station WFSU reports, some students say the return to campus feels eerie.
University officials say they're working to offer flexibility for students who aren't yet ready to return. May Campagna is a sophomore studying criminology. She says she appreciates the options from the university, but...
I think a lot of people are still a bit nervous to come on campus. They don't want to be put back in a situation where something like that could happen again. And also, like you said, there are a bunch of memorials, so everywhere we look, we're reminded about what happened.
The university has waived the mandatory attendance policy, and instructors are working to offer many classes online. University staff members have also been given the option of working remotely where possible. For NPR News, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Harvard University is suing to halt a Trump administration-ordered federal freeze on more than $2.2 billion in grants. The confrontation between the university and the administration intensified after the Trump administration demanded that Harvard limit activism on campus, institute reforms, potentially including changes in course content and student admissions. Harvard cited the First Amendment, saying it would not comply with an order violating its autonomy. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
On a Monday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Pope Francis led Catholics around the world for a dozen years, and for some younger adults, he is the Pope they've thought of as their own, concerned about the environment, the poor, and peace. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports on how some younger Catholics say they will remember Francis.
The young adult group at St. Monica's Catholic Church in Santa Monica, California, is where scores of members in their 20s and 30s meet, learn about the faith, and serve the community. One active member is 29-year-old software engineer Daniel Trin. During college in Philadelphia, he'd fallen away from his Catholic upbringing, but then Pope Francis visited the city during his one and only trip to the United States.
I remember going out there in that massive crowd just to see a glimpse of him.
The Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
At the time, I just really didn't know what he was all about.
Peace be with you.
What he learned was Francis's focus on serving the most vulnerable, important to Trin, who often volunteers cooking breakfast for the homeless on weekends. That encounter with Francis got him excited about the possibility of returning to the church.
Just the fact that he picked Francis as his Pope name, St. Francis, he was born very rich, but he gave up everything so that he could help those who were in need.
And it got him thinking about the kind of person Pope Francis was and the kind of person Daniel wanted to be.
I'd say that his teachings helped strengthen my faith.
A faith lived out in service. That's also important to St. Monica member Sean Zaribe, who works with people with disabilities. Francis, he says, heard people out, trying to bridge the divide between traditional and more progressive Catholics. As an example, he gives Francis's openness to priests blessing people in same-sex relationships.
Even if certain things of the church won't change, at least when people are feeling like they're being heard, it kind of piques their interest in their faith more.
Zaribe is 26, which means Francis was Pope longer than anyone else during his life, longer than John Paul II or Pope Benedict.
I think I was alive for JP2, but I didn't really care at the time. I was too young, I guess.
Three.
Yeah.
Jumping in there is Katie Sayegh, who serves on St. Monica's Parish Council. That's a leadership role. Many had hoped Francis would create more leadership opportunities for women in the church, like serving as deacons. She's disappointed he didn't.
You tend to feel like a second-class citizen, a little more extraneous. And so, you know, seeing him speak more on that and what unique roles we can play.
But she was deeply moved by the way Francis spoke about social issues, from the environment to respect for life.
So many people in the world today equate religion with hypocrisy. And when we say life is sacred, we mean that at all stages, of all people, at all places around the world. And he's been so vocal about caring for the elderly, caring for the poor, caring for immigrants and refugees and people that need to be seen and healed at all stages.
I always make a point to look up whose feet he's chosen to wash on Holy Thursday.
That's Katie Sayegh's husband, Gabriel.
He always picks someone that's probably doesn't have a voice, homeless person or prisoner, and in that small way gives them a voice, which is really powerful.
Powerful, because previous popes carried out that pre-Easter tradition, washing the feet of cardinals and bishops. Katie finds that departure inspirational and emblematic of Francis's way of serving the church.
He's challenged, frankly, everyone in the world to be a little bit more Christ-like. It's really helped me be proud to say that I'm Catholic.
And proud to live what Francis preached. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Santa Monica, California.
Today, the final phase of a historic antitrust trial against Google began in a Washington, D.C. courthouse. Last year, a federal judge had ruled the tech giant was abusing its control of the online search market. Now, he'll determine what penalties Google must face. I do want to note Google is a financial supporter of NPR, but we cover them as we would any other organization. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz was in court today and is here now to explain everything. Hey there.
Hi.
Hi. So before we get to the latest, I just want you to step back because this has been going on for a while. Remind us, what is at stake, what this case is about?
This has been going on for a while. It all began in 2020 when the Department of Justice filed an antitrust suit against Google. And last August, U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta ruled that Google has been acting as a monopoly in the search engine market. The main issue is that the company has paid Apple and Samsung to make Google the default search engine on their phones. And for the next few weeks, Judge Mehta will hear arguments from the DOJ and Google over what they think is the best remedy. And both sides are really far apart. And I should add that this case shouldn't be confused with another federal antitrust case against Google. Last week, a different federal judge ruled that Google has a monopoly in its online advertising business.
Okay, so to the latest in this case, walk me through what happened today.
Yeah, so the mood was a little tense as lawyers for Google and the government waited for Judge Mehta's arrival. Both sides offered roadmaps of what they will bring up during the trial and what kind of witnesses they'll call to testify. And over the next few weeks, that's expected to include Google CEO Sundar Pichai and senior VPs of Yahoo, Apple, Microsoft, and ChatGPT. And the government's most aggressive request is for Judge Mehta to order the tech company to sell off Chrome, which is the world's most popular browser. Lawyer David Dahlquist for the DOJ said today, Chrome drives billions in search revenue for Google, and selling it off would allow its rivals to compete. The DOJ is also asking that Google stop making payments to those phone makers to make sure its browser is their default option. But the government wants to go a step further and also make sure any remedy blocks Google from establishing these exclusive agreements for its generative AI products like its chatbot, Gemini.
Now, you said a moment ago the two sides are very far apart. So what did lawyers for Google have to say in response?
Yeah, Google has been saying for years that it has never acted as a monopoly and that it does intend to appeal once this part of the case is over. Its repeated argument has been people use Google because they want to, not because they have to. A lot of what Google presented in court today was along those same lines. A lawyer for Google, John Schmidtlein, argued that what the DOJ was presenting was really just a wish list for Google's competitors. He also claimed that a lot of what the DOJ wants just goes a bit too far. Like splitting off Chrome, Schmidtlein said that is totally unprecedented. And while Google has offered to delete the word exclusive from their search engine contracts with phone makers, he said agreements involving their AI products like Gemini shouldn't be changed.
Put this into context. What are you hearing when you ask about the wider potential impact of this case?
Yeah, we spoke to Rebecca Hall Allensworth. She's a professor of antitrust law at Vanderbilt Law School. She said this is the biggest antitrust case in decades.
This case is an extremely big deal. It's hard to overstate it. You know, it's at least as big a deal as the Microsoft case, which is the last big antitrust case that we had, and that was 25 years ago. It's up there with the greats in the casebook, you know, Standard Oil, Alcoa.
And Allensworth said the outcome for Google in this case is hard to predict, but forcing Google to divest from Chrome is not out of the question.
And NPR's Jacqueline Diaz, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A mental health initiative in Maine is helping older men find community and make friends. Ashley Milne-Tite reports, and a warning, this story mentions suicide statistics.
Maine has the oldest population in the country. Jess Mara is executive director of the Maine Council on Aging. She says getting older can be challenging for everyone, including men.
We kind of, as a stereotype, have this idea that men are okay. That's a stereotype that's wrong.
Men over 75 have the highest suicide rate in the U.S. There are many reasons for this, says Mary Gagnon of NAMI Maine, a mental health nonprofit.
Among them are loss, sickness, the perception of being a drain on others, and social isolation. But, she says,
the enemy of suicide is connection.
One effort to connect older men with others is happening in Harpswell, Maine, a coastal community, where volunteering is big, especially around food.
And then we've got American Chop Suey here, if you'd like to see that.
It all started when this volunteer-led group, Harpswell Aging at Home, noticed men were missing from a lot of their activities. Then drivers for their homemade food delivery service encountered many single older men who didn't get out or cook. Here's volunteer Sari Hardcastle.
So they're eating cereal or hot dogs or a peanut butter sandwich, and that's not a very good long-term solution.
She grabbed another volunteer, Tom Mahoney, and tasked him with coming up with something that would get men out and socializing with other guys. Mahoney says he had to be careful how he framed the idea.
If we said it was a support group for men, they're not going to come. Because it would indicate, I'm vulnerable, I need this. We don't want to be perceived as being vulnerable.
He and others landed on a monthly lunch named Romeo, retired older men eating out. He got the idea from other grassroots Romeo groups around the country. The latest lunch had around 55 guys in attendance. One of them is Sam Powers. He's traveled all over the world. He's now 80, lives alone, and he had a stroke last summer, which has affected his voice.
Would you describe yourself as quite independent?
Oh, yeah, stubbornly, stupidly independent.
Powers says he's met two or three new people at each lunch, and this is as close as he'll get to saying the lunches help him. As we drive away from Powers' apartment, Mahoney says there's nothing wrong with men being self-reliant.
But we still have a need, like anyone else, to be connected to people. That's what he was missing, but wasn't saying.
Jim Hayes isn't going to say it either. He's a lifelong Mainer and retired harbor master of nearby Bailey Island. He now attends the free Romeo lunches, too.
We've worked all our lives, and it's hard to get out of the chair, to get involved with something. You know, we lose our contacts with the outside world, and it takes something like this to pull us back in.
But he says the pulling is going well. Sari Hardcastle agrees. She says the Romeo men are going on to get together at other times.
It's very exciting. It's doing just what we wanted it to do, and just what all the research says is needed.
To encourage older men to become healthier and less isolated through human connection. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite.
And if you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis, you can call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump wants the Pentagon to take another look at missile defense. He wants to build something inspired by Israel's Iron Dome. But as NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, that will be much more complex and expensive.
In a speech to Congress earlier this year, President Trump laid out his plans for missile defense.
I'm asking Congress to fund a state-of-the-art Golden Dome missile defense shield to protect our homeland, all made in the USA.
Trump borrowed the name from an Israeli system known as Iron Dome, which has protected that country from rocket attacks for years.
Israel has it, other places have it, and the United States should have it too.
But experts say building Golden Dome is going to be a lot more work than building Iron Dome.
It's the difference between a kayak and a battleship.
Jeffrey Lewis is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey who looks at missile defenses. The first difference is the size of the landmass that needs to be protected. Israel is more than 400 times smaller than the U.S., and it's mostly flat desert that's easy to defend. Second, the U.S. and Israel are threatened by different kinds of missiles.
Iron Dome fundamentally is designed to deal with slow-moving, short-range projectiles.
Missiles and rockets fired from near the border that can typically fly just tens of miles. Russia and China have missiles pointed at the U.S., but they are huge, powerful, intercontinental ballistic missiles that soar into space and shriek back to Earth at hypersonic speeds. Iron Dome could never intercept them. In fact, these bigger missiles are hard for any existing missile defense system to intercept. Laura Grego is a physicist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She says the best thing to do is to try and hit these ICBMs right as they're launching from their silos. But
the launch phase of those missiles really only lasts 3 to 5 minutes. So you only have, you know, some hundreds of seconds that you have available to catch them as they're launching.
And this leads to the third big difference between the real Iron Dome and President Trump's futuristic Golden Dome. To hit these missiles early, a Golden Dome will likely need to include technology in space. The idea is to have satellites in orbit that could spot missiles as they leave the ground and then shoot them down at the beginning of their flight. It's an idea that's been thought of before. The problem, says Grego, is that the Earth is really big, and satellites spin around it really fast. So?
You need a lot of things in space in order to have them in the right place at the right time.
Grego was part of an independent panel set up by the American Physical Society, which took a look at missile defense. Earlier this year, they concluded
a constellation of about 16,000 interceptors would be needed to attempt to counter a rapid salvo of 10 solid propellant ICBMs.
The idea of having 16,000 satellites in orbit seemed impossible until recently. Elon Musk's company SpaceX has been building a constellation of internet satellites called Starlink.
Ignition, liftoff of the Falcon 9. Go SpaceX, go Starlink.
It's put thousands of satellites into orbit with plans to launch thousands more. Tom Carrico is director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says now is the time to take another look at space-based missile defenses.
It's a welcome development, and it's in some respects overdue.
Carrico says the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine show why these missile defenses are needed. Non-nuclear missiles have become a go-to weapon, he says, and Golden Dome could serve as a powerful deterrent.
So I don't want to just deter a nuclear exchange. I want to deter a conventional war with China and Russia, and we do that by raising the threshold.
The threshold for missile attacks of any kind. But Jeffrey Lewis is more skeptical. Conventional wars aside, Russia and China still depend on nuclear weapons to maintain a strategic balance with America. If we try and build a Golden Dome, he warns, they will rapidly expand and upgrade their nuclear arsenals in response.
We will end up with vastly larger Russian and Chinese nuclear forces. We will end up with the Russians and the Chinese having all kinds of crazy sci-fi weapons. In short, we will end up spending tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars to be in, at best, the same place we are today, and most likely a much worse place.
Because it could spark a new nuclear arms race. And Russia may already be preparing. The U.S. believes it's experimenting with ways of putting nuclear weapons in space in order to destroy large constellations of satellites like the ones needed for Golden Dome. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Stephanie Garber. In the late 1980s, Garber was driving through downtown Silver Spring, Maryland, when a large pickup truck hit her car. She was not injured, but the other driver was furious, claiming the accident was her fault and her car was completely wrecked. As she stood on the sidewalk, waiting for help to arrive, watching her car block traffic in the middle of rush hour, Garber began to cry.
And I was standing there and I was anxious and I was nervous and I felt guilty about keeping the traffic stopped, but my car wouldn't run. So I really was not myself. And I must have been quite a sight. All of a sudden, a lady that was very professionally dressed and obviously going into her work day came over to me with a full cup of hot tea, which she had clearly purchased at the coffee shop, which was right next door to the payphone where I was. And she handed it to me and she said, "Maybe this will help." And when I looked at her, I just felt such kindness coming my way at a time when I needed it. My anxiety lowered simply out of the fact that this was such a kind thing to do. And actually, I've never liked tea at all, but I drank every drop and I felt her compassion coming through with each swallow. I kept the little tag off the tea bag because I wanted to remember this moment. I knew it was a moment that would stay with me forever. I hope I said thank you to her, but I'm not sure. I went back the next morning at the same time thinking maybe I could find her, but I never did. I doubt if she knows it, but if I were to see her today, I would tell her thank you. You made a difference to me.
Stephanie Garber lives in Orlando, Florida. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T.
No jardim das rosas de sonho e medo, pelos canteiros de espinho e flores lá, quero ver você, olerê, olará, você me pegar. João abriu a porta, o sonho existia.